having a pay scale where you're not starting people at the top, right? So you get a lot of people that are like, oh, I'm just paying everyone X amount because, you know, my neighbor was doing it or the company I was at. And I'm like, you have absolutely no room to grow. You will never be able to give them a raise. You will never be able to add on a benefit, right? So it is understanding that the scale is not to be maxed out immediately, right? The scale is to live in for at least, like you say, 3 to 5 years before hopefully, maybe, we can get another rate increase.
Hi, my name is Steven.
Hi, I'm April.
This is the 3 Pi Squared ABA Business Leaders Podcast, where we discuss topics on how to create and grow an ethical and sustainable ABA practice.
Together, Steven and I owned a 7-figure ABA practice that provided both clinic and in-home services.
3 Pi Squared has helped over 900 ABA practices start up and expand with our comprehensive products and services geared specifically to ABA. Now, let's get to the podcast. Hello, everyone on ABA Business Leaders. This is our first ABA Business Leaders Live in a long time. And today we have Matt with ABA Digital Marketing. Hopefully I said that right. Joanna with Margin Keepers. And April. Do it.
April.
All right. So I'm just going to go over the logistics because this is a CEU event. So this is going to be our first CEU. So you're just going to have to bear with us.
Our first podcast.
Yes, podcast CEU. So if you want the CE for this event, you need to put your email address in the comments and Facebook, please, so that I can email you a link to log into your account. And then you can review the content and get the CE. After we finish the recording, our ACE provider is going to review the content, and it may be 1.5 CEs, maybe 0.5 a general, 0.5 a epic. I have no idea what it's going to be. So we're going to figure that out on the other side. So if you have any questions, just let me know. info@3pisquared.com. I will put that in the link, in the chat. The last thing is I'm going to copy the link to the readiness questionnaire in the Facebook chat. This will be a fun little exercise, I think, to do while you're taking this CE.
You're supposed to get that at the end so they can pay attention to us and not fill
that
out.
Don't pay
watching.
Attention to me. You don't want to pay attention to me. And see what kind of score you get. It'd be interesting to see. We're here to help. So if you have any questions at all, we want those questions. And the last thing I will say, and this is brand new to me, all right? So you're just going to have to, again, bear with me. But we should be able to do live call-ins. So I'm going to share that link if I can. And you can, we can bring you in if you are brave enough to do such. And I'm going to put that right there. And so you can try the call-in, you can try just commenting in the Facebook group video, and try out the link to the readiness and let us know what you scored if you feel comfortable sharing what you scored. It might be terrible and you might not want to share it. So that's it.
Are you going to be watching the comments?
Yeah, I'm going to be watching the comments. Cool. Yep.
And as also a resident marketing person, if you are watching a replay of this, still put your comments in. And April, Steven, or even myself, I'm in the group. We can all get back to them as well. So even if it's like a week later, you're watching the recording, still put your questions in and we'll get to it.
100%. Thanks for that reminder or that piece of information.
All right. I'm done.
All right. Okay. Well, welcome, everybody. Stephen did our introduction today, so I'm a little bit out of my routine here. All right, so as I guess you guys know, we're going to be talking about scaling today. So we're going to have a focus on financial and marketing when we talk about scaling today. There are a lot of other factors that we can look at with HIPAA and HR, quality assurance and things like that, but we're really going to focus on marketing and finances because we have the experts in house with us today, Matthew and Joanna. So we're thankful for them and for their time. And so I'm just going to start off by throwing out some questions and then we'll just have a discussion about it. All right. So this one is for Steven, actually, but of course anyone can answer. Why is scaling such an important conversation for us to have as ABA business owners right now?
Yeah, I mean, part of the issue with scaling that we run into a lot is that they've kind of got some of it, but not all of it. And what happens to a lot of BCBA-owned businesses, anybody listening or watching this, please feel free to share your comments. But, you know, you start off small, you're working 40 hours a week, right? And then you start hiring people. Now maybe you're working 50 hours a week. You hire more people, more clients. Now you're working 80 hours a week. And you can no longer micromanage your way out of this, right? You can no longer, you can't add another 20 hours to your week. You're going to go insane. And so everybody has their breaking point. So scaling is really important that you build your foundation, you have your processes in place, and the goals for how I'm going to delegate these things that I don't particularly enjoy doing, whether that's billing, marketing, you know, accounting, whatever it may be, so that as you start to grow, your utilization gets to a certain point, then you can add the admin people, you can add the BCBAs, you can add the techs to your system. And what happens a lot of times with a BCBA, a small ABA practice, is their quality starts off amazing, right? Because they are in control of every aspect of the company. But as they get into that 70, 80 hours, they just drop the ball on things. It just happens. This is just the way life is. And so the quality starts to come down as you add more people. And I hear very often that I left this my last practice because they were making me do unethical things. I didn't feel comfortable there. And now I own the same agency I left, right? Except it's my name, right? It's no longer somebody else's. So that's why it's really important to understand if you're ready to scale and that you have everything in place to scale. Does that make sense?
I would also add that just from a broad perspective, looking at the brand of ABA, the feeling that people get when they hear about ABA, it's important for good, strong, ethical ABA companies to scale because bad, unethical ABA companies are also scaling. You know, and it's not a conversation about big box, small box, private equity. That's a different thing. But if you have a strong ABA company that provides high quality ABA, for the love of God, like, let us help you scale because I want to see more of you in my backyard rather than a company that, you know, has scaled in the wrong direction and has optimized the wrong things. So that's one of the reasons why I get so passionate about marketing. And I'm so glad we have you on, Joanna, to talk about finance, because those are oftentimes big hiccups when it comes to scaling. And it has that effect of a good ethical ABA company scales, they struggle, they close their doors, and then we're left with a vacuum that a bad, successfully scaling ABA company then fills.
Yeah, totally. I think that, you know, one of the issues that a lot of companies have is they have lower than they would like rates. And then they're competing with those big box stores or, you know, ABA companies, you can call them that. And you know, these bigger ones are coming in and you know, they can give higher wages. And so with these lower rates and then that inability to scale because you don't have the systems in place really causes a lot of issues.
One thing I'd like to add in is a lot of times too, when the companies are deciding to scale or they've started their new company, like you said, Steven, you know, I didn't like how things were happening at this company, and because they were doing things unethical or they didn't care about the clients or whatever might be the case. And then I asked them, well, you know, how did you decide how much to pay people? Well, I'm paying them what they're paying them. And right. So then you really have to consider if you left a practice that was unethical or maybe got bought out by private equity and wasn't that concerned with the quality of care. You don't want to copy their financial practices, assuming right. that they're going to work for you.
Totally. Yeah, we just got a comment. Just had a tech cold call today, and their starting rate was 25% higher than I could afford to pay them. And I think a lot of, you know, these I don't know if I can call them unethical, maybe uninformed ABA practices, they're still, you know, hiring techs as contractors, you know, so they can afford to pay them 25% more because they're not having to pay payroll taxes, right? So that's another issue that I think a lot of these well-meaning, following the rules ABA providers struggle with.
Totally. Well, that kind of brings me to my next question for Joanna. And side note, we're in the middle of a blizzard. Our child's home. Our dog's over there growling. So I apologize for any background noise. Hopefully it's not too distracting. Joanna, from a financial standpoint, what are the biggest mistakes business owners make when they're trying to scale too soon?
Well, the first mistake is that they don't make sure they have a sound business model before moving forward. You know, they get in this mindset of wanting, you know, I want to intake more clients, I want to get more hours, I want to hire more people without sitting down to make sure that the current business model is sound. So just like Stephen was talking about, making sure you have processes in place so you're not working 50 to 80 to 100 hours a week, right? The same is true for the financial side. You want to make sure that the current business model you have, that the contracted rates you have, that the pay scales you're offering employees, that your overhead expenses, that all lines up to get you on a road to profit, right? A lot of times people think, oh, you're just talking about profit, right? Because you're an accountant, you only care about finances. But in order to help children, you must have profit, right? So it's essential to consider that. So the biggest mistake is just deciding to scale without sitting down and deciding, are there any things I need to change before, from the financial standpoint and operational, you should sit down and look at, do you have everything documented? Is it going to be easy for you to train people, right? Is on the finance side, is this going to work out? Because as you scale, you'll see an increase in overhead, right? And as overhead increases, what that does is that it causes your break-even billable hour point to increase, right? So as that increases, ABA companies are very sensitive to that because they, you know, there are periods, you know, when the holidays come or they might graduate students or they might, you know, not need to service clients anymore. Client might move away, right? If you become very sensitive to a billable hour break-even point, then you might go into losses and you have to be ready for that financially.
Yeah, exactly what you said about, you know, we're providing those services for kids. Do you want to talk a little bit about how that affects our business with providing continuity of services and things like that?
Well, I mean, it's obviously it's important that we can keep consistent hours, but I think that, like, just to build off Joanna's point, like, if you're losing $5 an hour on every hour that you bill, you're not going to be open, right? You're just not, it's not that the math doesn't math. And then what happens? That your company closes, right? Those employees lose their job. And so to provide ethical services, you have to be able to make a profit. Like it is your responsibility to make sure that the rates that you accept are going to lead to a company that can scale. So that if your rates are so low that you have to work 80 hours a week and get no income from your ABA company, this isn't going to work, right?
So Matt, what's the biggest misconception ABA business owners have about marketing when they start thinking about scaling?
I think when it comes to scaling, I see two big misconceptions. The first one is my wait list is massive. I never have to worry about marketing. And I experienced this when I was clinic director at one of my early companies I was with. When I came on, I asked the owner specifically about what the wait list looked like. And they said, oh, we have like a 70-kid wait list. We're never going to have to even look at marketing. We could quadruple our business size in a second. I'm just not ready for it. And I said, oh, sure. And I was new as a director. I was like, no worries. Don't need to double check that. And the reality was, is this business owner had collected their wait list for the last 3, 4, 5 years. These people had filled out a form and had never been contacted. So the wait list that we thought was 70 people, when it actually push came to shove, the reality was they only had about 3 active or ready to launch clients on their wait list. And so I think that's kind of one of the biggest struggles is that you think you have a massive wait list, but you have to look at the clients who are ready to launch, the ones who have their paperwork, you could turn around and take on their intake the next day. The other misconception is kind of the other side, and that is where, you know, build the field and they will come. The idea is I had a really successful marketing endeavor in terms of my first ABA clinic. As soon as I open up a new one, the word will spread and I'll instantly kind of get that same reaction. And the reality is that you have a lot of data that can help inform that, because that's not necessarily untrue. There are definitely ABA companies that have that. They're in the right spot with the right word of mouth and the right referral network that will happen. But there's clues. So look at your current leads per month, right? How many clients, real clients you could actually turn into, you know, a 15, 20, 25 hour a week kid. How many of those do you get a month? If you're getting 6 to 8 to 10 of those a month, then it's going to take you 2 to 3 months to fill 20 more slots, just based on the leads you're already getting. If you're getting 2 to 3 a month, but you happen to have a big wait list, well, then even if you open up a new clinic with an initial surge of 5 to 10 students, you're not going to be able to fill that clinic efficiently because you don't have the leads coming in. I think the second biggest misconception is that they don't realize that the answer is there in their data. They just have to look for it.
Well, how do you know if, so, okay, I'm trying to think where I want to go with this. So I'll just ask, like, how do you know if, like, referral generation works? And then on the other side, like, when you put in marketing strategies in a place, how do you know they work? Like, how, you know, because I know that a lot of times we talk about, oh, well, we just rely on referrals, or we have a huge wait list. we're fine. We rely on referrals because I'm too scared to touch anything else because of like all the ethic guidelines and stuff, right? I don't want to put anything out there on social media. And then it's like, okay, fine. I'll try some marketing stuff and I'll take a stab at it. Like, how do I know if it works?
Well, it comes back to KPIs, key performance indicators, and data. So I have a long-running theory. I'm working on better ideas and like more structured ideas. But marketing and behavior analysis, they're both behavior change tools, right? And so one day, a long time ago, John Watson pissed off Skinner, and they split up. And marketing and ABA never talked to each other again. I know that's Watson was before. I know the timeline. Anyway. And the reality is that the data tracking that we use for ABA can easily be applied to marketing and has successfully been applied and back and forth. So, for example, how do we know if a marketing campaign is successful? Well, what is the intervention? What is the effect on that intervention, independent to dependent variable? And is it replicatable? Probably not going to be doing a reversal on paid ad spend, but can we do a multiple baseline across locations? Can we do non-concurrent multiple baseline with different strategies? And so the idea is you have to know what to track. And if you don't, you can track a million different things. If you don't know what to track, track the easiest, most objective thing, just like we do in ABA, which is the ultimate result or the behavior. For marketing, that simply means the clients who are ready to launch. So if you're actively onboarding, every time you get a client, you're pushing them, then you would just look at the amount of clients started that month. if you are building up a wait list, you're trying to kind of like pull that slingshot back, then you can look at those ready to launch clients, the one who have their documentation in, or at least could have their documentation in if they, you know, had the time to get it in.
Anyone else have anything to say on that?
We have a question, oh, and I also have a question.
Okay, great.
So I'm going to ask my question first. All right. It's my question. So I'm just curious what your opinions are, both of you. What comes first, right? It's kind of chicken or the age, egg, or I don't have the money to market because I don't have the clients, and I don't have the clients because I haven't done any marketing. Like, how do you come up with that, you know, formula? When do I start, and how do I afford it based on the financials that I'm making right now?
I think on my end, then I'll let you tackle it, Joanna. I think for me, in typical marketing world, you would say spend the money first and get the return. Because really in marketing, what you look for is a 30-day turnaround. Can you spend money and then make it back in 30 days? The reality is, as an ABA, that's not even close to the timeline we look at. If we spend money in January, that means a lead comes in mid-January, they get the documentation by mid-February, their initial assessment is completed by mid-March. You know, you're looking at like a 90-day turnaround. So to me, I think that there are ways that you can spend time to market, local outreach, some SEO strategies, and then there are ways that you can spend cash to market, like paid ads. So, and this is where I'd love to get your thoughts, Joanne, on kind of the other side of it, is I would recommend find the margin, do free marketing, basically use your time, spend your time rather than your money. And then once you have the margin through all the other practices, then if you really want to pour some gasoline on the fire, then you can light it up with paid marketing methods.
Yeah. Yeah, so it all depends, right? I mean, if you have money, yes, spend right away. You know, if you did save up some money to start your practice, or perhaps you're still working a job at another company while you're starting this on the side and you do have money to spend on marketing, that would be great. But most people that I work with that are just starting out aren't in a position to do that. So yeah, I often advise them, you know, to go around, you know, local pediatricians, introduce yourself, leave some pamphlets, do what you can, you know, go to events, you know, network, the free stuff that Matt was talking about, until you have enough money to invest in a proper marketing plan. So it all depends, you know, some people might take out a loan, or because you might, if you're starting out, it's different than if you're expanding, right? Because if you're expanding, then you probably should have money aside for this plan, right? So if you're in the expansion phase, right, you should have set money aside. You should, your budget for this expansion should have included a thorough analysis of what marketing campaign you were going to do, right? So if you're going to work with Matt, you know, you call him up before, get an idea of what the cost is going to be, put that into your plan, you know, to be able to spend. So if you're scaling, probably you shouldn't be scaling unless you're in a position where you have enough money aside to invest in marketing. If you're starting off, then yeah, that advice Matt gave is great. You know, do what you can for free. And then as you can, then you can invest in some proper marketing.
Okay. All right, so we got two questions now. So what are thoughts on ethically stashing kids away on a wait list if you could potentially try to match them to another company around?
So I love the, if you've been, so I also, I'm a practitioner. I've been in the field for 10 years, and I'm a sucker for ascent-based care. So my thoughts on this line up exactly with the concurrent chains arrangement. I don't think you should restrict access to care. I think it's highly unethical to somehow pigeonhole somebody into waiting for your services. But I also don't think you should so aggressively pivot in the other direction that you're like referring somebody out. Like, no, don't be on my wait list, go somewhere else. And so the way I like to think about it is somebody pops in on your wait list, you know that realistically you can't serve them for X amount of time. The first thing you need to know is what that timeline is. You know, nothing sucks. And I have kids who are waiting for speech services right now. Nothing sucks than being told it's a 1 month wait list and then 4 months later have no contact. So have an understanding of realistically what your wait list is so you can inform and tell that to the person. And then be honest, hey, these are other companies that we know of that we've worked with. If that timeline doesn't work for you, but then also stand on your brand a little bit, stand on your quality, right? So if you have a strong marketing, a brand identity, and if you're proud of the services you provide, if you know that you're the best person in that area for early language skills because of your unique, specific experience, supervision, staff training, then I also think it's okay to respect a caregiver enough to allow them to wait for you, you know, as long as it's fully informed, right? So I'm kind of like, there's option A and option B, and you know everything about both. And if you want to stay with me for option B, this is the realistic expectation of what that looks like.
Yeah, we talk a lot about taking care of your wait list, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you can even offer, not always, but sometimes you can offer, you know, trainings or...
Yeah,
some
parent training,
right?
Support or something like
some
that.
Some kind of support,
Okay.
Was there another question?
Yeah, I got one more. Does marketing always cost money?
It always costs something. And I think, and this is where I would suggest a little bit of a pivot in mindset, because the one answer is no, you can spend your time, but spend your time, right? So especially in our field, a lot of us are revenue generators. You know, we can actively bill insurance to get money back. So our time is specifically worth something. But even if you're not a revenue generator, you're a CEO, you're an admin, you're in operations, that time is still worth something. So it's going to cost something. The question is it going to be effective? You know, so if you're going to spend time, you know, doing local outreach, then make sure you really go all in with local outreach. Don't spend two Fridays at the end of a month dropping off pamphlets. Like, get some data, create your list, you know, build your map and hit 20, 30, 50 locations. Send your emails, you know, do it really well so that the time you spend is going to give you a good return on investment. And similarly with paid ads, you know, there's nothing worse than hopping on with a potential client and them saying, yeah, we did some paid ads. We spent like $200-$300, didn't get any results. And what happened was they boosted one of their Facebook posts for $300 over a weekend and they didn't get any clicks. And the sad thing is that paid ads is hard. You know, it's a difficult, complex, time consuming thing. So I would say it is going to cost something. There are plenty of quote unquote time-based solutions like local outreach, story times with libraries, collaborating with the local coffee shops, more community-based activities to do, but it is going to cost something. And I think successful business owners really value their time as well.
Yeah, that's really important because what Matt's talking about, we call an accounting opportunity cost, right? Mm-hmm. Everything has a cost. You decide to walk the dog instead of watch a show. Well, the cost of walking the dog was not watching the show, right? So, and as the owners, a lot of times new owners, I see them like say, oh, I'm doing all this myself, like a lot of things, not just marketing, but the admin and the IT and this or that, right? And you really need to remember that you generate revenue, right? You could be billing out a service. So when you decide to do these other things, it does cost something. So you just need to keep that mindset, you know, what you don't need to be doing, you shouldn't be doing at the point you can afford not to be doing it.
I feel personally attacked. I'm doing all these bad things. That's totally what I do. I boost my Facebook posts for $20 a weekend because I feel it wanna. And it doesn't work. Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, and I totally, yeah, I did. I've not, it hasn't been for a while. But, and then, you know, that I just give my time away for free and
fine. And it's easy. It makes the numbers look better. And Joanna, I'm sure you know this better than anyone. It's easy to not put in your 9 p.m. to midnight hours on your spreadsheet. So it looks like you just gained an extra $200, $300 of profit that day or whatever. Yeah. You know, it's negative reinforcement. You know, we're avoiding thinking about it so that we can escape the reality that our business might not be making as much money as we think.
And as far as local marketing, this is something that I tell people to do all the time. But I think that, you know, just like you're both saying, it does take time to put together brochures and business cards and then actually go to these people or go to meetings or set up free parent training. Like, I know, Matt, that this is something that you're starting now. Do you want to talk about how yours works or what you recommend based on, on the stuff that you've been doing so far?
Yeah. So what Steven's talking about is my local outreach service that my marketing agency does. So when I stepped into the marketing game, it wasn't from the MBA marketing pipeline. It was a practitioner understanding what practitioners need and then putting that in, that combining that with my marketing skill and seeing what I could come up with. And one of the approaches that I like to think I kind of cobbled together and that I would love to really help y'all with is a cold outreach, you know, phone calls, emails meets true community local outreach. And so a lot of times BCBAs will drop off a couple pamphlets, they're talk to their kids' SLP, and they maybe will talk to like 3 to 4 people and it won't get anywhere. So when I say local outreach, and when I talk about that, spending the time doing it right, and you know, my agency does this, but you can do it yourself without hiring me, it's just gonna cost you some time. I mean, going on Google Maps and getting 200 names, you know, 200 libraries, SLPs, OTs, pediatricians, clinical psychologists, anybody who has a hand in your ideal client's journey, right? So that one kid that you can serve better than anybody else because of your specific expertise, what else are they doing when they're not applying for your ABA services? Right? Who interacts with them? Names, emails, addresses, and then treating it like you're at a call center and you sit down and you have your phone out and you have your spreadsheet and you're doing a phone call and then an email and then a follow-up with the goal of setting up a referral network, right? The goal is you are a local business owner and you are looking to generate a local network. And that SLP who you had a great meeting with might not have any clients to send you this month, but they also might have 4 clients to send you in 2 months from now. Right. And even though that SLP didn't send you somebody, the pediatrician might that month. And the reality is, and this is where the cold water gets splashed on an otherwise fun conversation, is you're going to get ghosted and you're going to get no's and you're going to get way more ignores than you're ever going to get meetings. And that's why the volume matters. 200, I've done it with 50. I've done it with 100. I've done it with 200. 100 to 200 names is when you start seeing an effect because you're going to go through a 70% no rate. You're going to go through tons of ignores so that you can then come face to face with the 20, the 15% of people that not only say yes, but are excited. Some of the coolest conversations I've been a part of is, you know, finding that diamond in the rough SLP who doesn't even have a website and accidentally set up a Google business profile 7 years ago, but has been owning a thriving SLP company for 7 years. And is, I'd love to work with other providers. Nobody ever reaches out to me for that. Hmm. And it's because you were 194 on the list, but you got to hit the list. So that is it's time intensive. It's kind of sucky because you get a lot of no's, but it is a incredibly effective way to build your local provider network. And you can do it yourself, right? There's nothing that an agency like me can do that's necessarily better than what you can do. An agency like mine just does it without you having to do it.
Right. It's super I think that local marketing and that outreach, you're a helper, let's help people. I think using that skill that you already have, it makes perfect sense. And then on the other side of things, Joanna, like I think, and I at least this is what I tell people, that payroll is going to be about 85 to 90%, especially if you're in-home, of your expenses when you count payroll taxes, you talk about professional liability is tied to how much your payroll is, practice management is tied to how many users you have, right? And so how important do you think it is to have that payroll in like a really good understanding of what you can afford to pay people when you're scaling like this?
Well, it's the probably the most important financial factor, right? Like you say, it's almost all your cost, all your revenue goes into payroll. If you start to scale on your rate, you know, the pay rates that you've set aren't within range to end with profit by adding on clients, because what happens is, right, is that there's two components, right? The payroll, right? And then the overhead, right? So if you have a clinic, the rent, you know, other softwares and all that, everything that's not related directly to payroll. And so as you grow, the overhead will grow. Maybe you didn't need an administrative employee before, but now you need one, right? Maybe you're scaling as your home base and you're going into a clinic. Okay, well, now you need a receptionist. You need someone to clean the clinic. You need utilities. You need the rent, right? So all those things are growing. So if you don't leave enough room in that payroll to cover these other expenses, you'll find yourself in a bad position, right? You also need to consider, like, in the scaling, right? So we've been talking a lot about client acquisition, but we all know that employee acquisition is just as important, right? They're the inventory, right? That's what we're selling. And if you need to be able to if you need to compete for employees in your area, you need to have room in those scales for benefits, right? In order to attract the best staff, or if you want people to stay with you, right? So it's a very important consideration before even beginning to scale, to really sit down and look at those. And if you find, you know, it's not enough, well, then you need to go back to your contracted rates. And then that opens up the whole discussion of, you know, do I need to try to renegotiate? Do I need to exit payers? Do I need to get some new contracts before I endeavor to scale?
Yeah. Rate negotiation is very important. And what do you do? Like, okay, so when I'm talking to someone about rate negotiation, even if, let's say, they did get it, right, this year, and they got a 1 or 2% increase, they're not going to get a ton. But yeah. How do you balance competing with other ABA providers in your area right now and knowing that your wages are going to increase over the next 3 years? And that's probably maybe if you're lucky, you're going to get another rate increase in 3 years. So, like, how do you make sure that your scale is wide enough that you can cover raises and, you know, worry about inflation and cost of living increases and still maintain a profit? Because every quarter you give to your employee that stays longer is great, right? But it's coming directly out of your bottom line, right? How do you manage that?
It's having, having a pay scale where you're not starting people at the top. Right. So you get a lot of people that are like, oh, I'm just paying everyone X amount because, you know, my neighbor was doing it or the company I was at. And I'm like, you have absolutely no room to grow. You will never be able to give them a raise. You will never be able to add on a benefit. Right. So it is understanding that the scale is not to be maxed out immediately. Right. The scale is to live in for at least, like you say, 3 to 5 years before hopefully maybe we can get another rate increase. Also, you know, like, In scale, you know, and so even though you're giving more weight in scaling, you're getting more quarters, right? So as you scale, you still can retain, you know, you could still end up having the same amount of profit you keep because you have, you know, more clients. So even though you're getting less of a profit on a per client because you have 50 clients instead of 10, it's ending up at the same profit.
All right. We have a question. Do you want to?
So we do have a question. In terms of working with these local companies, outside of dropping them off pamphlets or letting them know that you exist, what are things you find work best collaborating?
It's all about value. You know, it's not as simple as other industries where it's a you scratch my back, I scratch yours. But ultimately, you have to have a reason for talking to them that isn't selfish. And this is where, you know, I think this is where we call it in marketing positioning comes in. And all positioning is separating you from the rest of the people who they're also talking to. Like, what's specific about your ABA company? And how can the specific thing that you do great add value to the person down the road? A very simple one, right? I work with a company that's opening up a clinic in a more rural area. A very simple thing is there's not a lot of people around here, and we'd love to build a referral network. Can we meet so that we can set up a, so that if we have questions or if we have clients who have questions, we can send them to you. And so it's leading not with, can you give us clients, but how can we collaborate to give you clients, right? If there's any local Head Start or Early Step style programs, it's, hey, we have some time and some expertise. How can we help educate the people you serve? Like, what can we do for you? Because ultimately, the goal of this is to build a relationship, not a business partnership. We want to be able to be giving first with trainings, with resources, with clients of ours, so that when it comes time for them to, when some parent asks them, hey, do you have any recommendations for ABA? I tried out XYZ company, but they honestly kind of sucked, and I just don't know who to turn to. The SLP, instead of saying, oh, well, you can Google it, and here's like a list, they instead say, oh, you know, I actually talked to Matt the other day, and he was interesting. He talked a lot about, you know, quality of care and Ascent, and, you know, it kind of lined up with what I was thinking about too. So maybe try him. And that's really what I mean. I don't mean like a, you know, a passing back and forth clients as if they're commodities. What we're really looking to do is how can we support the other local businesses in our area and form that relationship with them so that they can support us back, which is why it's not a linear thing. It's not every person you meet with sends you 12 clients. It's a long term, it's a large volume, long acting marketing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Like even the referral, right? Like, should I refer my clients to another ABA provider? Well, if there is another one in your area, I can guarantee most ABA providers are not referring, right? They're not making that relationship. You may just in that itself, they then may refer you a few clients that they can't take on. So I'm looking at this as, this is one of the things that just that irks me sometimes is like looking at clients like they're yours, right? They don't belong to you in any, right? This is a human life, right? And so you're just trying to help people. And so I think use that skill that you already have developed so well in this relationship building, I think is really important.
So that's when, and that's such a great point, Stephen, is that whole idea of competition. Right? Because you don't want to give your clients to your competition. Well, let's take a step back, right? When I got my supervision and my experience in a hospital inpatient setting, I consider myself an expert in severe behavior. Right? What I did not do during my 3 years there was run an ABLES, was run a VBMAT, you know? So when I talk about positioning, when I talk about separating yourself from the pack, I mean, separate yourself in the way that it's clear that you have a different skill set than the next person, and they have a different skill set than you. So you're not competitors anymore. Right. You're peers again, because that's what we need is we need to go back to building relationships with peers instead of looking to edge out, you know, the local competitor. So when I was a clinic director, I would oftentimes refer kids out who needed more intensive language, because my clinic was not the right area for them. And I would tell the person, hey, I specialize in severe behavior. These are the things I can do. I don't specialize in language. So here's a kid who needs language. And then they would say, oh, that's crazy. I have a 12-year-old and we're about to discharge them because right. We don't know what to do. Right. And then they would send that. So the key there is positioning yourself. So when you're calling these people or when, especially with the ABA providers, it's not a competitor relationship. It is this is what I do really well. And I would love to work with and collaborate with somebody who doesn't do that as well and instead does something else better than I do.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think it's really important.
Yeah, so we have a question here. And if you're surrounded by big box PE, just search out the locals.
Big box is harder. I've had much less success collaborating with big box. I will say that it depends on who you contact. If you have Centria Healthcare surrounding you and you send your reach out email to info@Centria Healthcare, I would not have high hopes for a response. Instead, if you search out the clinical director, I do think you would probably get a response. Now, would you build the exact same type of collaborative, friendly, let's send clients and let's collaborate and let's work together? It probably won't be the same as local. But oftentimes I find that the clinic directors, the BCBA leads, are oftentimes great clinicians who just happen to be working at a different company than you. I will say, though, even if you're surrounded by big box ABA, you're not surrounded by big box SLP or OT or pediatrician. So I think that as soon as you think that there's not another person to reach out to, I'm willing to bet we could find another 100.
Yeah.
Joanne, I have a question for you about knowing if you're financially ready to scale. So are there specific numbers or benchmarks that a business owner should be looking for to know that they're financially ready to scale?
Well, I think if you know, when I'm looking at clients, I think they have a healthy profit margin, like net margin. So after they pay everything, you know, if they're between 15 to 25%, right? So if you're somewhere in that range and you haven't found room for improvement, right? You might be ready, but you have to be, conscious of, since most of the practices, right, you're owning it, right? I find that a lot of owners don't disconnect their personal financial situation from the business, right? So you might be looking, oh, I've got 20%. That's good. I'm doing great. Let's scale, right? But if you're drawing that 20% every month, right, if the owner is taking those profits out because they need them for their personal financial situation, then it might not be the right time to scale, right? So it's important to analyze both, because as we all know, there were business owners, we kind of become one, right, with our business, right? And so it's important to just not analyze, okay, the business is doing well, and but personally, I'm okay. I would be okay not drawing profit for, 6 months while I invest this money in marketing or, putting the down payment on the clinic or buying all the furniture, So you want to assess both personal and financial. You also want to assess a period of at least 12 months before. It can't be like, oh, great, I did 20% last month, right? So I'm ready. You want a period of 12 months because there is a lot of seasonality in this business, right? As we can all tell when the bank deposits dip in November and December, right? And so you want to make sure that you're looking at a 12-month period, that you're looking at it on accrual basis versus cash basis, right? So cash basis meaning that I'm just looking, I got this many deposits and I paid this many bills this month, and this is the money that's left. Because you might be looking at a period where you got a lot of back collections. So maybe you hadn't been paid for a couple months on a couple of kiddos because of a problem with the auth, and now that money came in, so this month is looking really good. But it's not really good. It's just that you got money from prior months that you had to spend money to make. So that's where looking at an accrual basis would be best. And what that means is that you're looking, so when you look at the revenue or the sales number, that's dependent on sessions rendered times contracted rates, right? So what you actually earned that month, not what you got, and then that you're looking at the expenses that month for that month. The biggest factor would be payroll, because we all know we have to process payroll in arrears because we need time to get the records and then process it. The bank takes the money, right? So shifting that payroll to a date of service, right? And so looking at, let's say, March on a date of service scale, right? What was the revenue for the dates of service in March? And what was the payroll for those dates of service? Are there any bills I didn't pay in March because maybe it's a quarterly bill? Like maybe I'm paying the workers' comp quarterly, so I didn't, pay, but that's actually going to be, $1,500. And so it's $500 for this month, So that's what I mean by accrual basis. So actual picture of what's going on financially. And you don't need to have your accounting done on accrual. You can always just ask your accountant, hey, can you do a snapshot for me? Can you tell me what it would have looked like for the last 6 months or 12 months on accrual so I can analyze how the business is going? And that's just a matter of tracking data, essentially, right? So I know that it's hard for a lot of people to understand, but it's just a different way of tracking your financial data that helps more clearly evaluate the position.
Yeah. So what signs or what warning signs or what information tells you that it's absolutely not time to scale yet? Because I think, so I was talking to a business owner the other day and she said that she's just growing. She's starting off in her business and she just got a lot of new potential clients, right? Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, okay, well, does that mean I need to start growing? Do I need to start hiring? Should I hire a BCBA now? So whether it's that example or just in general, like when should you
not? Well, if you don't have... Yeah, so if you don't have money in the bank, right, so you should have at least 3 to 6 months worth of your business expenses saved up. If you're not at a position where you have that, that's probably like a flag of maybe now's not right, right? There's 100 other factors that don't have to do with financing that you guys know better than I do, right, as far as processes, documentation, right, about how things are going to be done, right? From a financial perspective, if you don't have money in the bank, and if you that would be a red flag, don't do it yet. Another red flag is if you don't have like a sound process for monitoring your accounts receivable, especially don't do it. So, and what I mean by that is that you as the owner, you don't have to be an expert, but you have to know what report you're asking your biller for. And you need to be able to glance over it and kind of pinpoint, oh, this is something I should ask about. This is okay over here, right? You need to have a very good understanding of how the billing is done, not just the insurance side, but the patient responsibility side as well. I can't tell you how many companies I talk to that don't even consider the patient responsibility. It's essential. They're subtracting that from the money they give you. And if they subtract it from the rates that you're already struggling with, you're going to have trouble, right? So you need to make sure you have a sound process for accounts receivable, both patient and insurance or other payers, and that you have money in the bank. That'd be the most important, besides, you know, making sure that, you know, your sound business model, which is looking at that accrual snapshot and saying, okay, great, yeah, my rates are sufficient for me to pay people fairly, offer the benefits I want, spend on the overhead that I need, and still have profit left.
Yeah, I know hiring that next BCBA, whether it's the first next or the sixth or seventh next, right, BCBA, was always really challenging, you know, depending on the payer and how long you knew you were going to have to wait before they were credentialed in the network and all of those things. But also knowing that you have this growing wait list, and sometimes it's really easy to want to jump the gun and just,
help everyone.
Yeah. And it can kind of blow up pretty quickly. We know from experience,
yeah,
luckily it didn't blow up for us, but we did have a lot of those like, jumps of, okay, whoa, hold on a minute. Like, let's get on stable ground. I don't think we realize what we just did.
Yeah.
And so we need to acclimate to where we are and figure out what's going on to know, okay, how to do this differently next time. Yeah. Sadly, margin keepers wasn't around for us back then.
Yes.
But yeah, I think that, the information that you guys are both sharing today, I've been a little reflective during this podcast because I just am just taking in the wealth of knowledge that you have. And I'm just like, oh, this is so valuable. And there's a little bit of emotion there too, because sure, I'm like, why didn't I know this stuff? Right. So it's a little frustrating.
I think when you start to expand or scale, like it exposes things that you didn't realize were a problem. And so it's really important to feel confident in the systems that you have. And, you know, like you said, Joanna, like it's really hard to disassociate yourself from the business. And if your entire like life is tied up in this business, it may not be time to scale, right? Like if you can't leave for a day, then it's probably not time yet.
You completely are like, that's exactly where my train of thought was going, right? Because it's like and it's not just ABA business leaders. No, I'm sure it's just all like entrepreneurs and small business owners, right? Like it's like an extension of us, totally. Our child or whatever, right? So it can be very, very difficult to separate.
We have a question.
do you have any suggestions for helping to more efficiently market niche services, screen potential families that might be a great fit for our services? Our largest program primarily provides services for students in group or classroom settings, which of course requires some emerging group learning skills. You're moving the screen on me.
Sorry.
We have hundreds of families seeking our services and spend a lot of time trying to find the ones that are ready for the setting we have.
So is the question about getting more or screening the ones you have?
Yeah, if you're still on, Lauren, if you don't mind expanding on that a bit.
So while she's kind of plugging that, I would say in terms of marketing niche services, it comes down to telling people about your niche services. And the way you're going to tell people are ultimately through the same buckets, whether you're advertising early intervention or very niche Dungeons and Dragons social groups. And that is local outreach by communicating to people in your local community. Content marketing, which is, you know, long-term SEO strategies or social media, or paid ads, which is, you know, paying to explain your niche to somebody. Now, in terms of better filtering, I'm a huge component. My marketing agency is called Digital Marketing for a reason. I'm a huge proponent of if you have too many leads, then make sure you're working with the highest quality leads. And instead of giving a little bit of time to everyone, give all of your times to the highly qualified people, which means you need some filtering. And it means you have to accept the fact that you may have 200 people asking for your social group. And we need to build a system to get rid of 190 of them, right? And typically, you can do that through email automations. You can do that through better form filtering. You can do that through text automations. But ultimately, the goal is to identify as early in the funnel or the entry point as possible that this is a perfect customer. The best way to figure that out is to look at your current perfect customers. If you have a school group that is going amazing and it is giving you amazing outcomes for your clients, what is the exact demographics and what do those clients have in common that you can then use to target your next 10? And then ask those questions. Make sure your forms are HIPAA compliant, but make sure that, you know, filter out those people so that no matter how many leads you get, you're ending with those 10 highly qualified, and then tell that those people, spend an hour, 2 hours, whatever time you have, they are the perfect customer, and then prove it to them. Show them, you know, your program and show them how it was built for them in mind. And that would be my suggestions for filtering. Look at your current clients who are having amazing outcomes and then copy paste.
Well, so I want to switch a little bit to talking more about sustainable growth. We've kind of been focusing on, you know, growing. So Joanna, how do businesses know when it's time to slow down their expansion?
Well, I think that depends on each of the business owner's goals, right? So as a business owner, you should sit down, you should consider like what the end game is, right? So when you get to a certain point, like let's say you run this business until retirement, right? You're either going to sell the business, right? Or you could have gotten it to a place to run on its own, right? And if it is, then you just sit back and you get your profit share, right? So that's the first question, right? Of, you know, what's the long-term goal of my business, right? Either or will end with a certain financial result. So you have to ask yourself, you know, what is my ideal income at retirement, right? So first you decide what's my dream here? I'm going to stop working at 60, and at 60, I'd like, you know, to take home X amount of money every year to be comfortable. And so that's when you then decide, okay, well then you kind of back into your ideal, revenue number that would generate that net income that would allow that lifestyle, right? Or if your goal is to sell it, right, you need to understand like that's a moving factor, right? So right now they're selling the firms, you know, between let's say 3 and 4 times EBITDA with ad backs, right? That might not be the same. It used to be way more. When I started this firm, you used to get way more money when you sold your company than what you get now. And so, it's kind of hard to tell because you don't know what it'll be like at the time that you decide to exit, but you still need to sit down and think about, you know, what's my ideal income? How much money does my company need to generate for me to get that either via sale or me positioning people to run the business and me getting my profit share at my desired retirement age? And then I would say just grow it up until that point. We all have different goals, right? Some people don't want, and it's okay. Like some people don't want to scale at all, and that's okay, right? It just whatever's going to make you happy. So it's really about sitting back, thinking about what is your personal long-term goal? How are you going to get there? What's the amount of money needed to get there? And so I'll grow my business up until that point, and then I'll be happy and I'll stop and make the plan that way.
Yeah, I think that because oftentimes we're kind of talking to like the local, you know, the local, like small to medium, not the big private equity folks. The big PE folks, their model of profit is based on scaling, right? So they are scaling machines. The purpose of that purchase is to 10x, 30x the amount of clinics so that then they can exit themselves, right? So their model is very different than the average business owner's model. And I think that sometimes as, you know, business owners, we're chasing the wrong people. We're using the wrong people as models, right? The majority, I think, of ABA businesses don't need, and to your point, Joanna, should focus on, because of their goals, a scaling model. Now, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't get one location, two location, three locations. But scaling for scaling's sake is only the right decision if the end result of extremely fast scaling is a profitable exit, you know? Scaling because you're trying to spread strong and ethical ABA, and scaling slowly and safely so that you're respecting your staff and you're respecting your time, and you're making this, you're building something to outlast you, like when you sit back and let it run in retirement. It's a very different timeline, and there's not nearly as much pressure. We were talking earlier about when is it the wrong time to scale. And I can say as an entrepreneur, as I'm sure we've all felt this, there is millions of times where it is a great opportunity, but the wrong time. You know, you happen to get an influx of 10 clients in a month, and you're like, this is it. I can bring them on, increase revenue by X amount, get that lease, and suddenly I'm there. But you haven't prepped any RBTs for onboarding. Great opportunity, wrong time. And I think it's okay to wait, right? It's okay to let an amazing, perfect opportunity pass you by, because there's also going to be another one next week or next month. And I think, you know, as a business owner myself, that's a really hard pill to swallow, and I'm still getting used to it. But it's true. So I think, you know, should everyone scale? Well, it depends on if you want to, but ultimately scaling to scale, just because you see that, you know, YZ private equity company has opened up, you know, 500 different clinics in the last 2 years, you're chasing the wrong goal.
Yeah, can I say one thing to that? So I think like a lot of ABA businesses like that I have spoken to, they're building a company to escape the company that they don't want to be a part of anymore, and they haven't really put much thought into how this ends.
Yeah.
And so there isn't that long-term, you know, projection of I want it to be this big, So I would invite everyone to just kind of take some time, and what does this like perfect in your perfect dream world, what does this look like? Because I was talking to one guy this week. He said, my dream company was going to have 10 employees. It was going to be small. And Stephen, yesterday I hired my 100th employee. Wow, that's really different, right? And so, like, what is your end result? And if you're growing just because you can, that you may end up with a company that you absolutely hate.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important. What is your limit? When are you going to be satisfied? And I think that goes back to both of what you said. Like, when? Because I do this myself, right? Like, I'm just going to grow, because what else am I supposed to do? I got to get bigger, right? And I need somebody to say, well, wait a second, you're fine. You don't need to get any bigger. You don't need to do anything else. So I would recommend all of you out there growing just for the fun of it. I don't know. That's probably not the best reason to grow.
Oh, I think I feel like that's a great segue into this next question we have here. Speaking of not wanting to scale at all, can Matthew speak to hypothetical husband, wife, owners, or one wants to eventually scale and one doesn't? And I just absolutely...
We lived it.
That was us. I was like, stop. No. And then you would find... You were like, look, this is how we could get more and more clients. Oh, this is how we could do this. Yeah. Oh, we could get... And I was like, no.
The elevator has a 100th floor. You obviously go to the 100th floor.
But my goal in this was like, I wanted to know, I wanted to have a face and a name. I wanted to be able to go out and meet every family that we provided services for. And it got beyond that. And I could no longer do that. And my interest and happiness, not that it's just about happiness, but like it plummeted, right? It wasn't the same for me anymore. Yeah. We took it back down and then I was where I wanted to be. And then he started 3 Pi Squared. So totally get that. But if you guys want to speak on that,
the husband and wife thing, right? Like I know I run my CPA practice with my husband. Right. You really need to sit down together and write down your ideal lifestyle. What do you value in life? What do you want to have time for? Like, as you know, being American, growing up in a country where it's always like such capitalism, go, 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 right? It's hard. It's ingrained in us to want to succeed. Success means money. Money, more money means more success, right? So, but we all need to sit back and just, you know, take a look at what, at the end of our life, what did we want that life to look like? Yeah. Even, you know, write your eulogy. What do you want people to say about you? Do you want your kids to say you were a good mother, a good father? You know, do you want the parents of the kids you helped to remember your name to say that you made a difference in their life, right? So just, I think it's really important, especially when there's two of you, to sit down and have that activity together. And then just like everything in marriage, you compromise, right? You come to terms with where you'll go.
I don't think my wife is part of the Facebook group, but it sounds like that comment could have come straight from her. So I'm the scaler in their relationship, and my wife is the local, like, let's build something and then take a breath. I think that ultimately, in my experience, if all the conversations are about the business, you're probably having the wrong conversations. You know, if there are so many times when I'm looking at the next 10 steps and I'm talking about, like, you know, partnerships and collaborations and new products and hiring 5 more people, and the other person, my wife, the other person in the equation, is looking at the next couple days, you know, whether that be stress with the business or something totally outside of the business. I think when it comes to having those conversations, I think it's really important to sit down and not talk about the business, because ultimately, and I know there are some people who truly believe that their business is their life. And maybe that does work for them. I'm not gonna say anything bad about them, because if it works, it works. But ultimately, I think that your life is your life, and your business is tools to fulfill, you know, tools to help you fulfill whatever life you want. And I think if there's a 100th floor, but at the same time, it's like, are we even trying to get to the 100th floor, or are we in the wrong building? Because for me, what I typically find is my wife is at the park and I'm at the elevator, you know, and I'm looking at the next 20 floors and my wife is like, so should we put our kids in soccer practice or not? And so I don't know. There's no magic solution there. But I think if you're talking about the business, you're probably having the wrong conversation.
Yeah, Stephen and I talk about being in the same car but going two different destinations, right? It's like, it's not possible. You can't, you know.
Yeah, I think we could turn this into a therapy session.
I mean, totally, 100%.
More thing on that. I will say, if you are running a business together and you're both staff-facing, like I know you and Stephen and April, you guys were both interacting with your staff, I do think it's worth a week off of work, a week of lost revenue to get on the same page.
Yeah.
Because 100%. I have been part of companies where I have one business owner who's desperately scaling and the other one who is like not even close to that mindset. Yep. And it is hard. It is like, it ends up putting them against each other. And as a staff, that's the type of thing that makes me want to leave because I can't trust, you know, not just as an RBT, but like as a clinic director, somebody who like wants to be in this business long-term, I need to trust that I know the direction of the company. Yep. And so I think it's worth losing revenue to align on that direction.
I 100% agree. I mean, and even though that there are times through our journey where we weren't there, right? And you know, we've learned a lot, and that's part of our life now. In fact, last year, we moved where we are. We have a lot because we wanted to slow down. And I was talking a little bit to that before the podcast started recording, but it's like we have to be so intentional, and we have to at the beginning of the year. We even put block weeks out, at least quarterly, and sometimes more. And we're being more realistic about our summer this year to make sure we're blocking even more time out to make sure we have that balance that works for us and where we are in our business. And I think that when we were more in that role of ABA provider, business direct providing, then there's even another level there that we don't have in this consulting type business, right? It's directly dealing with the kids and the families and, you know, the children you're providing services for. And it is definitely worth to take that time to get on that same page.
I would recommend, and this isn't just for like husband and wife. This is like, if you're partnerships in any way, like personally, what I like to do is suggest to separate, come up with your perfect dream. Don't let anyone influence your dream. Just put it on paper, envision it as best you can, and then come together and see, is this even feasible? Like you said, are you two in two separate buildings? Or are you just disputing whether you should go to the 21st floor or the 20th floor? Because that's very different. And so I think it's a good exercise to do.
It's important too to note that by the time that Steven gets to the 100th floor, the skyscraper already built 50 more. Well, then and now he might want to get a 150. Yeah, exactly. So it's like you could go on like this forever. Yeah, it could be a rat race to the end.
I'm a mouse in a wheel. I'm a hamster in a wheel. That's it. That's
and
me.
That's why I block off Thomas off on the calendar. And I'm like, honey, we're off. Like, Our son is a great reminder. We've trained him well. He's like, excuse me, mommy, I believe this is intentional time and your screen is in your hand. Could you please go put your screen in the other room? He's very good at advocating, keeping us in line with that, right? Mm-hmm. All right, I do have another question as we wrap up here. So kind of in line with where, you know, we talked about sustainable growth and when is that time to slow down. If marketing is working well and suddenly too many clients are coming in at once, what should a business do to avoid overloading their team?
If too many clients are coming in terms of you can't support them and you feel like you're spending money just to fill a wait list, don't do anything right away. Take a breath. Don't change your marketing strategy. You don't want to change something that is working too well until you're positive that it actually is working too well. There are times when your leads are going to dip. There are times when your leads are going to increase. You know, think about like Christmas time, you're not going to get as many applications. Back to school time, you probably will. Open enrollment, another hot season. If you suddenly have this massive shift in your marketing to where it's going too well or even not well enough, but it's been going at the correct rate for a while, don't do anything just yet. If the marketing method that you're using is free, basically you did all your front work with local outreach and SEO, content marketing, all of that stuff, and now it's just continuing to generate leads, there's nothing much to do. Keep going, find a way, if you really want to optimize, find a way to serve those clients in some way. Maybe that is monthly paid parent training nights if you have that many leads that you're looking to optimize. Maybe it's simply sending them automated emails to keep them warm for when you're ready. Maybe it is lining up with all of your other business metrics and scaling. If you're using paid marketing methods, like let's say you're spending $3,000 a month, you're one location, you're spending $3,000 on Google and Meta ads, suddenly you're getting 12 highly qualified leads per month, and you realistically can only onboard two or three, then when you're positive that it wasn't a blip in your graph and it's sustainably too much, then I would probably start toning down the cash flow. I always want you to be in a like a lead overflow. And ultimately, we always want to make sure that if something were to happen and we need to turn it back on, especially with paid ads, we can always flip that switch. So I really don't recommend, unless there's for certain business models, absolutely turning it off. You know, if you're going to spend if you want the ability to spend $3,000 to get 15 leads per month, then you need to be okay spending $100 to $300 consistently to continue to validate that ad complexity.
Hey, ABA business owners, struggling to navigate the complex world of ABA practice management?
You're not alone. We've been there. And that's why we created the ABA Business Leaders Membership. It's your how-to guide for everything you need to run a successful, ethical ABA practice.
From compliance to culture, from billing to hiring, we've got you covered with in-depth videos and insider advice you'll wish you had years ago.
Absolutely. But guess what? You don't have to figure it out alone. Our ABA Business Leaders membership isn't just a guide. It's your growth accelerator featuring 34 CEUs to keep you and your team on the cutting edge.
That's right. Plus, you get exclusive access to content you can't find anywhere else. Think webinars, live Q&As, real-life success stories from practices making it happen.
And the community aspect is unbeatable. Imagine being connected to a network of ABA business owners, sharing, learning, and evolving together.
No more second-guessing your business decisions or wondering if there's a better way. With the ABA Business Leaders membership, clarity, confidence, and continuous learning are what you're signing on for.
So, if you're all in on elevating your ABA practice, join us. It's time your business not just survived, but thrived.
Head on over to 3piesquared.com and check out the ABA Business Leaders membership. Let's take your practice to the next level together.
Great. I think we're going to take our last question for today. So with the topic of client influx, slowly scaling and finding that balance, what do you recommend timeline-wise? Slow growth has been my goal. I don't want to scale too quickly, even if I can financially sustain it. I plan on staggering onboarding of clients, having a hiring list based on client needs through being in the field and general networking.
I would say from the lead flow side, before I look at a growth, I want to be sure that I can, let's say before I look at a lease for a new clinic, I want to make sure I can break even with the clients I have. And when I pull those clients in, I can at least pull the staff in at the same time. So hiring is just the other side of the client coin in terms of marketing. So how many high quality applications are you getting? And are they both in line to where you could support that growth? In terms of marketing, I would say slow versus fast to me has less of a factor as much as the actual metrics. With the only asterisk, if you know a growth season, you know, an expansion means you're only going to sleep 4 hours a night, then you probably don't want to do back-to-back growth seasons if you know it's going to stretch. And then in terms of the financial things, that's a whole nother one that I won't bungle. I'll leave that to you, Joanna.
Yeah, I mean, so from what the listener described, it sounds like she's got a good approach. She's taking things slow, making sure things are right, and that's what you should be doing before, you know, financially investing is part of like that. She should really just write down, you know, the plan, you know, of, you know, like we talked about, sit down, what's the end game? How do I see my life? You know, where do I want to go? Be really intentional about the steps that she takes to grow, making sure, you know, that, you know, she's got decent margins to be able to offer more benefits or more perks to the employees to attract more staff as she grows. But I think the way she, what she wrote sounded like a good plan.
All right. I wanted to give each one of you the opportunity to give listeners one last piece of advice. whether it be a business or a marketing strategy, advice in general, or in line with scaling.
Well, I can start. If your wife joins a Facebook group to then comment on the Facebook group to slow down, you should probably slow down. Just kidding. I don't think that was her.
That's funny.
But I think in terms of marketing, I would say just acknowledge that it's a part of your business model. You know, I think you said it earlier, Joanna, a business has got to make money. You can be a nonprofit, but you still have to pay your staff. You can be a for-profit company that takes a tiny little sliver. But ultimately, you know, nobody's going to stick with a business they work 80 hours a week at if they're getting $10,000 a year. So one of the growth levers you can use is a strong, you know, safe, ethical marketing campaign. And so just acknowledge that it's there and start tracking some of that baby data. You know, how many leads are coming your way? How many people are, you know, ready to launch clients? And then just see where you're at. You might be way, way more advanced than you think. You might be getting way more leads than you need, or you might realize, oh crap, I don't have a lead a month, you know? In that case, change your behavior off of that.
The advice I'd give is, you know, invest in your staff. It's very important, like take time, sit with them, meet with them. What are their dreams? What are the, you know, what do they hope to accomplish? Make them feel part of your company, because if you scale and you start to lose staff, we all know it's a nightmare, right? You need to make sure that you've got good people that see the vision that you see, that have values in line with the values you hope to achieve at your company, in order to make scaling more feasible.
Wonderful advice from both of you. Stephen, you have anything?
I would just say to the last comment, like, I think slow versus fast, I think that's very, that's a perspective, right? Very subjective.
What is slow?
What is slow? Yeah, because, like, if you have two BCBAs right now and you add a third, like, you're adding a third
to your company. That might not be slow.
Right? And where if you've got 10 BCBAs, you're adding one, that's a different, like, it's just a different place, right? So I think, especially when you're starting, adding one BCBA, I wouldn't add two right away. That's just a lot. Again, you're going to learn. Your new staff will break your system, and that's probably a good thing, right? And so you can see where your weaknesses are, and you can see where you need to increase your processes and procedures. So yeah, I think that slow is subjective, but I think at the same time, having that plan, where do I want to be in 5 years? Because slow might be adding one BCBA every year, or slow could be adding five BCBAs every year, right? Like, it just depends on the goals that you're looking at. So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for everyone who attended today.
Yeah.
So I really
appreciate all the comments. It was great questions. It was awesome.
Their interaction was amazing. Yep. So, Stephen, any follow-up? So, with this being the first CEU podcast, mm-hmm. or podcast-style CEU, those of you who haven't already should put their email address.
Yes, please put your email in the comments.
What if they don't want to put their email address on Facebook?
Well, then,
comments?
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even think about that. That's a great question. So just private message me, and then I will work with you to get access to the CE.
And as we build this, it will be a lot less cumbersome to access the CEUs.
Yes.
We're learning and we're trying new things, right? And so Also, those of you who don't already listen, we have a podcast.
We do.
This will be part of that podcast. So where can they find our podcast?
Spotify, Apple Podcast, Three Pi Square. Yeah,
Three Pi Square and ABA Business Leaders. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Well, thank you so much for our expert panel here today. We appreciate you so much. And I hope everyone has a great day.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Hopefully it was helpful. If you would like to gain access to this entire video, and actually our entire library of videos, please join our ABA Business Leaders membership. You can find that at www.3pisquare.com.